Success is absolutely a team effort. And any great endeavors, I think this is most true with difficult endeavors, success is all about assembling the right skills.
My name is Josh Fink, and I'm the managing member and founder of Luma Group. Today, we are honored to be joined by Hans Bishop, president, co-founder, and board co-chair of Altos Labs. Hans also currently serves as chairman of Sana Biotechnology and is a board member of Lyell and Agilent Technologies. I've been fortunate to work closely with Hans as an investor and collaborator for a number of years. Altos is a Luma Group portfolio company, and we could not be prouder to be speaking to Hans today. Hans has over 30 years of experience in the biotechnology industry. Hans, thank you so much for joining us. Let's kick off with you telling us your story. I know listeners would love to learn more about your background. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? And most importantly, what got you inspired to pursue a career in biotechnology?
Lovely to be with you, Josh, and thank you for those kind words. I grew up in the UK. I studied chemistry at university, knew that I wanted to have a career in science, and quite early on thought, what science is more important and interesting than the science of medicine? I started my career at a big pharma company in the UK called Glaxo, and spent pretty much the first half of my career in big pharma companies. Then moved, I guess the real beginning of my career, rather than the beginning of my training, was when I joined one of the early biotech companies that came out of the West Coast called Chiron. Sadly, no longer with us. It was ultimately acquired by Novartis.
How was that move from big pharma to a small startup biotech company?
Well, Chiron wasn't small. It was already an established company with approved products and revenues. It was a real established company, but it was different. And I guess it was the beginning of a journey that ultimately led me to co-founding my first company in Seattle called Juno Therapeutics in 2013. And that was really the beginning of trying to be an entrepreneur.
It's amazing. Tell us more about Juno, because you touched on it. Let's discuss CAR T immunotherapies. As background for our listeners, Juno was a pioneer in these therapies, which use your body's own immune system to help fight cancer. When Juno was launched in 2013, cell therapy was a completely nascent field, and there's still a lot more to do in this field. How do we reach more patients with cell therapies?
We should start by actually recognizing the physician scientists that gave birth to this field, because great breakthroughs in medicine, and I think cellular immunotherapy, CAR T therapy, is undoubtedly a great breakthrough. They nearly always start in research institutes or the great hospitals of our country. And CAR T therapy was something that a relatively small group of physician scientists were working away on for years, and with very little attention, because most people thought it was an idea that was never going to work. And then a number of key people, Carl June, Michel Sadelained, Stan Riddell, I'm going to forget some names here, Michael Jensen, made early versions of these treatments and treated them in early clinical trials. And the results were extraordinary. These patients were all patients with different types of blood cancer, but stories from patients that had large masses they could feel. I remember a story of a patient that described this large mass in his neck, and he was at a baseball game, and he described feeling it melt away. When these physicians, you know, started getting these very early responses, they realized they needed far more resources than you can get in a research institute to turn these into medicines that could help thousands and tens of thousands of people. And that's where a number of companies were formed. Juno was one of them. There were three at the beginning, where we figured out how to really scale up and improve those technologies. Now, your question was, what do we need to do to get these breakthroughs that are approved medicines today, helping people with blood cancers? to help more people. And there's a number of things. We need to make them easier and cheaper to manufacture. And we need to figure out how to make them work in solid cancers. Solid cancers are far more common than blood cancers. And so if we can replicate the success we've had of CAR T therapy in blood cancers, if we can replicate that in solid cancers, we will help many more patients.
And where do you think we are in that development?
I think we're at the beginning of having data to show that ultimately we're going to figure out how to make this work. It's harder, and I'm happy to explain why it's much harder to make CAR T work in solid cancers than it is blood cancers, if that's interesting to you and your listeners, but it's definitely much harder. But I think there are data coming now that are very encouraging.
And that would be revolutionary for medicine. Hans, you've also had an illustrious career in the cutting-edge diagnostic space with the first clinically validated multi-cancer early detection test, GRAIL, which are blood-based tests. And for our listeners' benefit, only five types of cancer are recommended screening tests: breast and colorectal, lung for those at risk, cervical and prostate. However, nearly 70% of deaths are caused by cancers without recommended screening, which is why blood-based tests like GRAIL's are so critical. How can we continue to advance the diagnostic space and make this more accessible?
Early detection of cancer is arguably the biggest single opportunity for reducing death from cancer and the morbidity associated with cancer treatments. Approximately, I won't remember these numbers precisely, but if you detect a cancer, and I'm averaging across all the different cancers, at stage one, you know, more than 90% of patients diagnosed at that stage will be alive in 5 years. Conversely, if you detect cancer at stage four, around 10%, maybe it's a little bit more these days, will be alive at 5 years. So, you know, the benefit to us, remember, cancer is going to affect one in two men in their lifetime and one in three women, that the benefits of early detection are enormous. That's just the human benefits, let alone the cost avoided benefits. And as you rightly say, today we only screen for a very small number of cancers. Whilst we know men have got a one in two chance of getting it in their lifetime, we've got no idea which cancer we're going to get. The big idea that GRAIL pioneered is a simple test that can detect many, many cancers. The GRAIL test today, I think, detects approximately 50 different cancers. If you can screen for that in the over 50s once a year at patients' annual physical, there's now an opportunity to detect many of these cancers earlier. The test still has to show that turns into an overall survival benefit, but I'm optimistic it will. And I'm optimistic that GRAIL's ultimate success will accelerate this field, more investment in this field, and even better tests in the future.
It's amazing. I mean, Hans, you're in the unique position where when we think about kind of the biggest ideas in biotech today, you've been involved with two of some of the biggest opportunities and ideas in biotech today. What are some of the lessons learned from both GRAIL and from Juno, both successes and failures, and how has that informed who you are today and how you go about operating today?
I think I learned through experience something about myself that says there's no greater privilege than working on an idea that you think is going to be transformative. You don't know when you start. By the way, when we started Juno and we described to potential partners that could help us finance the company what we were doing, some companies almost chuckled because they thought it was a ridiculous idea. I can still remember some of the meetings where, you know, big successful companies sort of almost in a fatherly way said, that's never going to work. But here's all the reasons it won't work. And of course, when you set out to do something transformative, there's no guarantee of success. And your listeners probably don't appreciate actually just how risky drug development is. Of the ideas, the medicines, the potential medicines, I should say, that make it to a first in human clinical trial, 95% of them fail. So if you're in this business, you have to be in it because you love trying. You can't be too wedded to success. You need a little bit of luck to be successful because you can do everything right time and time again, and you can fail time and time again. But I think what I learned is if you're working on something that you deeply care about, every day is something that you enjoy. There are bad days, obviously. And also, by picking ideas that really can be transformative, you get the best people to sign up. And there is no greater joy than working on an important problem with great people. And that's my recipe now, you know, is that myself and my colleagues believe if it's made to work, it will be really transformative. And then surround yourself with brilliant people that care about it as much as you do, that will do everything they can to try and make it work. And it's an amazing way of spending one's time.
And you think as a leader that fundamentally helps you attract and retain some of the best and brightest?
Yeah. The people that work in our industry do it because they really care about the outcome. And they want their fingerprints on something that helps people. And the bigger the idea, the more people it can help, the more transformative the benefit, the better the people that will sign up to it.
That's amazing. What, as you think back to your Grail days, to your Juno days, what were some of the hardest days?
The hardest days are, without doubt, the days when you get bad data, or the days when a patient on your clinical trial doesn't do well. You know, there are days when you don't know if you've got a company or a drug, but all you can do is do the work, try and understand the new data that comes to you, and try and figure out what the right next step is.
Makes sense. Now moving to Altos, talk to us about the founding idea of the company. How and why did you and your co-founders, early investors, double-click on regenerative medicine? Where did the idea come from? How did you ultimately get the company off the ground?
The credit all goes to Rick Klausner, one of my two partners, because it was Rick taking walks with colleagues during COVID that gave himself the task of figuring out what is the single biggest idea one could think about, the most transformative idea in medicine. And Rick had been actually, like, frankly, probably most of us, incredibly skeptical about the cell rejuvenation, sometimes called anti-aging field, for good reason. The quality of science coming out of that field had been variable, said politely. But he came to the view that if one could figure out how to rejuvenate cells, which, by the way, sets up the opportunity of not just managing a disease or slowing a disease down, it sets up the opportunity of truly reversing a disease, taking someone with a disease and truly curing them. It was Rick that came up with that idea and then convened with some other colleagues, not me at the time, a conference of who he felt were the thought leaders in the space, and came away from that conference with a belief that this is doable. Then he started conversations with myself and Hal and others, and we rejoined forces. The three of us have worked together on all the prior companies we've talked about, and those were the beginnings of the company.
I mean, this seems like it has the potential to be the biggest opportunity that you've ever worked on. It seems like it has the potential to completely transform medicine as we know it.
I agree with that. It's a fact, as thankful as we are for all the medicines we have today, that when you think about the diseases that afflict most people, and those are chronic diseases that most commonly appear in middle life, the medicines we have are incredibly helpful, but they, if you're lucky, they stop the progression of the disease. Most oftentimes, they slow the progression. They don't cure it. If we can get rid of those diseases, the benefits to individuals and to society will be enormous.
And Hans, maybe for some of our listeners who aren't as familiar with regenerative medicine, How might you summarize it?
That's a tough question. Well, maybe I'd summarize it this way. The spark that's got us and many others excited starts with work done by Professor Yamanaka, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering four transcription factors that if you culture cells, any cells, you can scratch off my 60-year-old skin cells, culture them with what are called the Yamanaka factors now. You can take those old 60-year-old skin cells and you can turn them into pluripotent stem cells. Now, these are protocells that have the ability to de-differentiate into any cell. Now, in the field of rejuvenation medicine, we don't want to make stem cells. Actually, making stem cells in a human would be, inside a human would be bad. But following Shinya's great breakthrough, many scientists studied what they were doing, and one that's now at Altos, a remarkable scientist called Juan Carlos Belmonte, asked if that process of going from a differentiated cell, even a diseased cell, back to a stem cell, whether that was a process that could be controlled. And Juan Carlos, in fact, pioneered something, a process of controlling that allows you to stop that process before the cell loses any of its identity. So now you can take a diseased cell and rejuvenate it to the point that it's still a skin cell or a kidney cell, but now it's lost its problems and it's a healthy cell. It's called partial reprogramming. And papers and animal data with various forms of that process, I think, have encouraged all of us about the potential. Now, we still don't know exactly how those transcription factors are working. But part of how Altos is organized is to really understand them, because by understanding it, we can figure out the best way of replicating that process, the safest way of replicating that process, and ultimately, over time, the most cost-effective way of doing it. There are all sorts of different ways of looking at what's happening in a cell associated with this partial reprogramming that are clues for us to figure out how to rejuvenate and reprogram cells.
It's amazing. Hans, you touched on the importance of mission and mission being a driving factor in bringing together and retaining the best and brightest people. And that seems to be true in a hyperscaled way at Altos. One, if not the most important aspects of building a company, is the team itself and the people you bring together. And you've put together a truly world-class team at Altos, including four Nobel Prize laureates and a group of some of the most impressive minds in the longevity space. The individuals working at Altos are second to none in their accomplishments. As we build Luma, I've been heavily focused on the people and building the right culture. I'm curious, how did you build a team that is not just a group of all-stars, but also an innovative and cohesive culture?
Yeah, well, I don't take credit for assembling all of these people. I mean, Rick and Hal have played an extraordinary and unique role in doing that. And I agree with you that the individuals that have signed up to this mission, whether they're on the board or the team, are truly extraordinary. I know it's an often overused phrase, but I don't think it's overused at Altos one bit. And of course, the key about assembling brilliant people and making sure that they work is creating an environment where they're productive and aligning behind a mission. And I feel the people at Altos everyone cares as much about achieving that mission as we do.
As you think about your career in pharma, as you think about Juno, Grail, now Altos, what would be your advice to budding entrepreneurs in biotech and venture and beyond?
Success is absolutely a team effort. And any great endeavors, I think this is most true with difficult endeavors, success is all about assembling the right skills. And the right skills, by the way, obviously include in the company itself, but they also include the network around the company, great investors like you, Josh, and others that sign up for supporting a vision. and know that the path to success is twisty and turny, but are prepared to trust in teams and quality work and see things through. And it's equally true, forming relationships with the great physician scientists in our great hospitals is another network effect, and in fact, patient associations. It's really about having the right goal and the right people and the right networks.
As you know, at the core of our investment theme at Luma is a deep commitment to investing in companies that are providing better outcomes for patients. Within this, a key objective is to globalize and democratize access to healthcare products by making healthcare cheaper, faster, better, because all humans are created equal and all humans deserve the best possible healthcare they can get. In your view, how can we, over time, democratize Altos's discoveries when the time is right?
Well, the first thing I'd say is the health priorities in the global South are clearly today still somewhat different towards those in the West. And it's true that most of the money spent on medical research today is imbalanced towards the diseases that we encounter in the West. I wouldn't answer your question by assuming that solving the problem of cost in the West will necessarily solve the problem in the global South. Over time, it will, because health problems are converging.
But there's more fundamental problems.
Yeah. Now, the second thing I'd say is the patent system, I think, will always be a foundation of how we create an economic incentive for investors to take big risk in this risky field. If there isn't a period where if you're successful, you're going to make some money, there's no point in investing. And the thing that props up the whole business of making medicines are patents. And we need to absolutely make sure that patents are preserved, not abused, preserved. Because what happens in medicine is after a period of time, this patent goes away, and society essentially gets those medicines pretty much for free, cost plus a little bit. That system works better for some types of medicines than others, which if you want, we can get into, but we can solve the problem about where it's not working as well. So that's the bedrock of how we make sure that more people in society get access to better medicines. But there are also things that we need to think about in terms of the way we research and regulate the development of medicines, because that process is slow and expensive. And whilst it's difficult and there's no easy answer, I think we just have to believe that there are advances we could make there.
In terms of drug development.
In terms of drug development.
Doing it cheaper, faster, better.
Yeah.
Another key theme we're focused on here is the impact of AI and machine learning on biotech. We've just published a white paper on this topic right now. How do you see AI impacting Altos and the broader industry, both in the near term and over the longer term?
It's such a difficult question. How can one be anything but incredibly excited about what AI can contribute in a general sense? I mean, we've all experienced ChatGPT-4, and we've all heard the rumors about how much better 5 is going to be. And what that technology does is very impressive, recognizing it's still young. If you extrapolate from the speed at which AI is improving and ask how it could impact medicine, I don't think you can come up with anything other than a positive answer that over time, it's going to be incredibly important. But I also think that phrase, I don't know who came up with it, that people tend to overestimate the short-term impact of trends and underestimate the long-term impact. I think that
holds true
absolutely
for AI.
True of AI in medicine. I don't know about it in other fields. Hard to exaggerate how complex a cell is, let alone tissue, let alone an organ, let alone an organism.
And getting the data sets.
Getting the data sets is a huge task that we're really only just beginning to apply ourselves to in a truly structured, systematic way. I think AI is going to be an enormous benefit to making better medicines. And I think it's probably going to take longer and be harder than we think today.
Are you already starting to see AI have an impact on workflows and processes?
Yeah. We have an extraordinary group here at Altos, and we're really excited about their early results. And there's many examples of, I think, really interesting companies out there that are looking at different elements of how we make drugs and trying to improve different parts of that ecosystem. I think it's a really exciting time. But your question sort of implied predict how quickly it's going to benefit. I think we just got to work at it. Yeah, we could get big surprises early too. I'm just saying I think it's hard to forecast.
Right. But you need to focus on it.
Definitely.
Given your depth and breadth within biotech and pharma, outside of what we've talked about, what are some of the other areas or trends that excite you?
I suppose you have to be an optimist to do what we do. There could be an optimistic filter here, but I do think we're in a golden age of science for human biology. When I started my career, pretty much every medicine was a small molecule. For your listeners, that means a chemical, like an aspirin, molecular weight 150. And early in my career, a whole new modality of medicines was invented by the biotechnology industry that came out of California, where we are today. And that field of medicines that's led to a new type of drug called antibodies are made totally differently. You know, they've got a molecular weight in the hundreds of thousands. They're giant molecules compared to chemicals. And they're made in a completely different way. Actually, the technology looks more like brewing technology. There's genetic technology embedded in it as well. Those medicines are arguably now more important than small molecules. And now we're in a field where, based on understanding the human genome, we not only understand how errors in the human genome lead to different diseases, but scientists like Jennifer Doudna and others have developed these tools that lead to something called gene therapy, where we can actually put in a missing gene if that's the reason for a disease, or we can cut out a bad gene if that's the reason for a disease. And the technologies around that, whilst early, are improving every year. And so there's now a whole new modality of medicines that are going to allow us to address problems that small molecules and antibodies didn't allow. And I think because of that, that the next 10, 15, 20 years is likely to be extraordinary.
So you think we're in the early days of this golden age of biotechnology and the science?
Yeah, we're in the early age of the next phase of biotechnology.
And as you think about this golden age and where the science is coming out of, is it mainly US? Do you see it coming out of other parts of the world?
Well, science is by its very nature, a global endeavor. You know, there are incredible scientists and universities and research institutions everywhere. But there's no doubt in my mind, the single best place in the world to do this work is the United States. And it's to do with the ecosystem. It's not helpful if you're a scientist with a great idea and no one's going to give you the money to develop it. The reason this is the best place in the world is because of the confluence of amazing researchers, academic researchers, amazing people that are prepared to risk things starting new companies, investors that are prepared to support them. There are some strains around FDA, but I believe you take a long view, a regulatory approach that also cares about the same outcomes. Yeah, so there's no doubt in my mind, this is still by far the best place to do this work.
So even though you have cutting-edge science coming out of many places around the world, the ecosystem here is incredibly unique.
I mean, as someone that was born in Britain, I'm not entirely happy that many of the best scientists there have to leave that country to come here. Even aspiring entrepreneurs. I couldn't have started Juno in the UK. Not a chance. Right. It's a shame because the academic, I think the entrepreneurial spirit in that country is good, and clearly the academic science and clinical medicine is great. Yeah, but
it's not the US.
Yeah, it's a long way from being the US.
Tell us what's next for Altos and you. Where do you see the company in the next 5, 10, 25 years?
It's about doing the work, and it's about staying open-minded, and it's about learning from the new data we generate. Sometimes it will be good, sometimes it will be bad. But the great thing about this place is the minds we have that are not going to be distracted. They're not going to kid themselves something's good when it's not. They're not shy of doing the hard work of progressing it. And I think many of us here, and I rely on my science colleagues on this point, there's a deep belief that the problem we're trying to solve is solvable and that we're going to solve it. Whether that takes, which is implied in your question, whether that takes 3 years, 5 years, 15 years, I don't know. And it's my job as the business person here to make sure that we have the runway and the resources to do the work. Well, we've all got our favorite disease that we want to eradicate. They often come from very personal reasons, a family member that was afflicted, or knowing you have a genetic mutation yourself. And the twinkle in my eye is if we could solve neurodegeneration and dementia. It's just, my mother died of it, so I'll declare my conflict of interest, but it's such a dehumanizing, awful disease. And it afflicts so many people. And the indirect consequences of the disease are enormous as well. And there are, of course, a number of different types of very important and problematic neurodegenerative diseases, but I'll pick that one as the poster child. If we can reverse that, frankly, if we could come up with a therapy that postponed the symptoms by 5 years, when you think about when the disease generally onsets, even that would be huge. We're studying neurodegeneration. There are a number of other diseases that are also really important. So I'm picking my favorite. It's not necessarily the company's favorite.
But so important and so critical.
Yeah.
Especially as life expectancies continue to increase around the globe. And this is something that will eventually afflict most humans.
Yeah. Scary thought.
Very scary. To end on a general note, what are you the most excited about in the biotechnology industry looking forward when you think about the industry writ large?
I think these new technologies, and I didn't mention, by the way, and I should have done, the speed at which we make progress is also very correlated to how well we can measure certain things. And there's a whole parallel industry of technologies that help us study a single cell and what proteins it's making. And I'm not going to mention all of them, but that field is developing at a fast pace too, the field of analytics and diagnostics, you know, for the purposes of research and genetics, obviously. They're clearly an incredibly important part of the ecosystem that will help us understand how to better utilize, in the broader sense, you know, the technologies that fit under the umbrella of gene therapy.
And big pharma, what role do you see big pharma playing in this golden age?
They're still enormously important. You know, their ability, when a medicine is approved, to get it to millions of people, not thousands of people, is unparalleled. They're present in hundreds of different countries. But by the way, their ability, because of the infrastructure they have, when one gets a really encouraging early clinical signal, to massively stand up the clinical trials that are needed to understand all the different types of patients that may benefit. There's no one else other than those big companies that can do that. Look at the story of one of the most important new cancer medicines are called checkpoint inhibitors. They correct a problem that cancer uses to evade the immune system. And the leading companies in this space, there are more than one, have literally studied hundreds of different combination therapies and hundreds of different subtypes of cancer. And even if a biotech had the resources to do that, it would take a decade to build the infrastructure to do that. They remain a very important part of the ecosystem.
When it comes to commercialization, I mean, nobody can commercialize like that.
Yeah, that's true too.
And how do you think the role of venture, the role of public capital markets to help finance this golden age in biotechnology? How do you think, we obviously saw a lot of euphoria over the COVID period. We saw a big downturn in the market over 2022. If you were an investor in this field. You're an operator, but if you were an investor in this field, either on the venture side, on the public side, how might you think about it? How would you best deploy capital and invest to take advantage of this golden opportunity?
I don't know how to answer that, as I'm not an investor. I would just underscore again, because I think it's underappreciated, certainly by people outside of this field, that companies like Juno, companies like Grail, companies like Altos, and the companies that have led to the biggest breakthroughs in human medicine, none of them would exist were it not for venture investors and capital market investors. None of them. Most of the innovation that benefits human health starts in small companies. Actually, it starts in universities and then it's picked up by small companies. The big companies play a role, but they're not the most innovative. Without venture, there would be no community of biotechnology companies. And as I said earlier, you never know which of the good ideas is going to work. So you just have to try many. And that's why the United States is incredible, because there are great investors that are prepared to bet on themselves, to pick those winners, and many of them are very good at it. How they do it is probably something you can talk more about than me.
Hans, we've known each other for a long while. We've worked on many opportunities together. What advice would you give me running the group? We're a new firm. We started last year. We've started investing, assembling our team, our advisors, very excited about the opportunity set. What, having seen me in action, what advice would you give me? Where would, if you were in my shoes, where would you double down? What should we be seeking out? What should we be avoiding? You have, I'm sure, some unique perspectives, both of myself and Luma Group, and keen to learn as much as I can.
I think the phenotype of investor that all of the people on my side of the table like, because experience says they're the ones that add most value, investors that are thorough, the investors that are too quick to conclude your idea is a good one. One worries about those a bit, because when you hit the inevitable pothole, it's more of a surprise.
Right.
So you want investors that are thorough, and you want investors that are good listeners, and you want investors that care about the mission. And that's one of the reasons I love working with you, because you and your group do all of those things. And I find those investors are the ones that ultimately are the most successful, and they're the ones that are the most value added to work with.
And as we expand Luma, as we grow Luma over time, and as we assess opportunities and look for opportunities, it sounds like you're saying there's two key things we should look for. It's obviously the science and the scale of the opportunity, but it's also the people. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yeah. And I think it is absolutely possible to diligent good science. I want to be clear. I'm not saying you can predict the future of good science, but you can absolutely diligence rigorously done experiments, and you can absolutely diligence people that design experiments free of bias. You know, you can design experiments to try and give you the answer you want, but they're not helpful.
Right.
You want to design experiments to help you know the truth. And negative experiments in that regard are as helpful as positive experiments. And so diligencing good science, I think, is something that can be done, and I don't think it's always done to the same degree.
Yeah.
And then it's about strategy. You can diligence a good science, but there will always be twists and turns ahead. So making sure that the business strategy, the funding strategy, how many projects you work on in a company, making sure all of that set of issues fits together coherently. That's the second level of things that can help a company make sure it's optimizing its chances to get good data by the time it needs to raise money the next time.
Well, Hans, thank you so much for joining me today and your support of Luma Group. This has been incredibly insightful, a terrific discussion, and I'm deeply grateful for our relationship, our friendship, And I think this is only the beginning of our journey. There's so much ahead for us to do and accomplish that ultimately will be a lot of fun. But even more importantly, the impact we'll be able to have on human health outcomes, on solving diseases that are today uncurable, and on democratizing health will be really great. And that, I know, is what keeps us both highly motivated. It makes it even more fun to work together. And I think the past and what we've done together is extraordinary. Where we are is extraordinary. But the future, though, there'll be bumps, as you said, along the road. The future will be even brighter than the past. So Hans, thank you so much. Thank you for your time, and looking forward to continuing our journey together.
Me too, Josh. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Illuminations. The show notes include links to any resources mentioned in today's show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review.